From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Adrian Brody. He won this year's Oscar for Best Actor for his performance in The Pianist. He plays a loser who becomes a ventriloquist in the new film Dummy. Also, actor Miriam Colon. Because of her Puerto Rican accent, it was difficult to get roles in the 50s and 60s, so she mostly played Mexicans in Westerns like Gunsmoke, Bonanza, and Marlon Brando's film One Eyed Jacks. More recently, she's co-starred in Scarface, Lone Star, and All the Pretty Horses. Her new movie, The Blue Diner, is about to be shown on public TV. And Milo Miles reviews the new CD from Carlos Guitarlos. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stasio. According to the Wall Street Journal Online and CNBC, New York Stock Exchange Chairman Dick Grasso resigned today. The resignation was announced after an emergency meeting of the Stock Exchange Board of Directors. Grasso stepping down amid rising controversy over his $140 million pay package. Yesterday, four pension fund leaders called for Grasso to step down, condemning his payout as inappropriate for a regulator. A 10th Democrat officially entered the race for president today. Retired General Wesley Clark announced his candidacy in Little Rock, Arkansas. NPR's Greg Allen reports.
Wesley Clark hinted for months that he was considering a run for the presidency. A Draft Clark movement gathered signatures from some 50,000 supporters and $1.5 million in campaign pledges. In Little Rock, Clark said his campaign will ask the administration some tough questions.
Why has America lost 2.7 million jobs? Why has America lost the prospect of a $5 trillion surplus and turned it into a $5 trillion deficit that deepens every day?
Clark, a retired four-star general who led U.S. and NATO forces in Kosovo, has also been an outspoken critic of the war in Iraq and what he says has been a lack of planning for the post-war period. He starts his campaign with a big challenge. He has little money and just the beginnings of an organization, and the primaries and caucuses are just 4 months away. Greg Allen, NPR News.
Arab leaders today denounced Washington's veto of last night's UN resolution, the Security Council measure aimed to shield Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat from Israeli expulsion or assassination. From Beirut, Kate Seeley reports.
Egypt's foreign minister warned today that the U.S. veto would only encourage Israeli aggression. He said Washington had to make clear that its veto was not a green light to Israel to move against Yasser Arafat. In Yemen, President Ali Abdullah Saleh said the American veto would help foster extremism and escalate terrorism in the region. Arab states strongly backed the Syrian-sponsored UN resolution. It demanded that Israel not deport or threaten the safety of Arafat. The measure followed a decision by Israel's cabinet to expel the Palestinian president, although no timeline was set. In Cairo, an Arab League spokesman said members were considering convening an emergency summit to discuss the crisis. Kate Seeley, NPR News, Beirut.
Israel has put off a decision on where to run a controversial security barrier through the West Bank. Prime Minister Ariel Sharon announced the delay after the U.S. threatened to reduce its $9 billion loan package over the issue. Israel says the fence is essential to stop Palestinian bombers and gunmen from slipping into its borders to carry out attacks. Palestinians have criticized what they call the apartheid wall, saying it's an attempt to divide Palestinian communities and take over disputed land. On Wall Street, the Dow is off 21 points, the Nasdaq down 4. You're listening to NPR News. More than 200,000 people have been ordered out of their homes as Hurricane Isabel approaches the mid-Atlantic shore. Isabel is still a strong Category 2 hurricane today, even though winds have decreased slightly to 105 miles an hour. It's expected to hit North Carolina's Outer Banks in the morning. Ed Rappaport says folks there need to prepare for flooding.
A storm surge of up to 11 feet is likely near into the east and north of where the hurricane makes landfall. We have concern over freshwater flooding from rainfall over inland areas.
Governors of North Carolina, Virginia, Maryland, Delaware, and the mayor of Washington, D.C. declared states of emergency, which enables them to mobilize workers and activate the National Guard. R.J. Reynolds Tobacco announced it will cut 2,600 jobs nationwide, about 40% of its workforce. From member station WFDD, Denise Franklin reports from Winston-Salem, North Carolina.
Nearly 1,700 of the job losses are in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, the city where R.J. Reynolds Tobacco is based. One-third of the jobs are in manufacturing. The others are salaried workers, most of whom volunteer to leave. The rest of the job eliminations are in the sales force scattered across the country. The company blames increased competition from major manufacturers and the new discounted cigarette brands. Reynolds spokesperson Maura Payne says the decision to eliminate jobs was difficult.
But we simply had to fundamentally change how we operate Reynolds Tobacco in order to deliver profit growth.
The job cuts are part of Reynolds' plans to reduce costs by $1 billion by the end of 2005. For NPR News, I'm Denise Franklin in Winston-Salem, North Carolina.
Stock prices were generally lower today. The Dow is off 21 points, the Nasdaq down 4. I'm Frank Stasio, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Radio Shack, featuring the new Radio Shack MasterCard credit card. Details in stores. Radio Shack. You've got questions, we've got answers.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Adrian Brody, won this year's Academy Award for Best Actor for his performance in The Pianist. It was based on the true story of Vladislav Spielman, a Jewish pianist in Warsaw who survived the Holocaust by hiding from the Nazis. Brody has also been featured in Spike Lee's film Summer of Sam, Barry Levinson's Liberty Heights, Ken Loach's Bread and Roses, and he starred in the independent film Restaurant. Now he's starring in the independent film Dummy, which was actually shot before The Pianist. He plays a young man who is unemployed, still living with his parents and sister in the suburbs. His fantasy is to become a ventriloquist, so even though his family mocks him, he buys a dummy and starts teaching himself how to throw his voice. He expresses himself more freely through his dummy than he can on his own. Here's a scene in which he's talking with his dummy. The dummy has been criticizing him for being a loser and not having any friends.
I guess I didn't really have that many friends in high school. I didn't really have any. What about Thangora? Yeah, I guess we were friends. You know, she didn't have many friends either. Go figure. Kind of stayed close, even when I went off to college. You went to college? Yeah. Went to community college for 2 years. Ooh, a regular Einstein. Damn, I stopped going because I didn't really like it. You failed out of community college. You are a moron. Well, I didn't fail. I just needed to work at my own speed. Oh, so you're slow. No. Look, the thing I don't understand is, you always knew you wanted to be a ventriloquist. Why'd you wait so long to do it? Well, I just think people need to go at their own pace, and there were other things that I had to do. Well, I got news for you, Dunny. You're almost 30 years old. You quit your job to die a doll. You failed out of community college. And you live at home with your parents. You are a loser.
I asked Adrian Brody how he learned ventriloquism for the film.
Well, I think, you know, when you're doing independent movies, and most movies, you rarely have enough time to prepare. And I was coming off another film and going right into another one right after this, and I had about 2 weeks to learn how to become a ventriloquist. Fortunately, the character was a mediocre ventriloquist, and so I was perfect. And so I basically lived with this dummy and slept with the dummy, which...
You slept with the dummy?
Everyone thought I was a little strange.
Why did you need to sleep with the dummy?
Well, it had to become a part of me, in a sense. It had to become someone I was very comfortable with. And I basically took him with me and incorporated him in my daily activities and would watch programs on TV. I remember researching it and watching all this old footage of ventriloquists and Edgar Bergman, and I would be watching programs and commenting on their routine and discussing it with my dummy. And you know, my mom would come over and visit, and I'd be laying in bed with a wooden creature.
So
a little wooden boy.
Wait till the tabloids hear about
strange.
This.
Yes, I'm sure they'll have a field day.
So you had to develop a voice for your dummy.
Right.
Who taught you how to do it?
Well, I worked with a coach who is an actual ventriloquist who built the dummy. We had one custom built for me. And they have ventriloquist tapes that you can actually purchase and work at home, and you basically practice the alphabet, and certain letters are harder to pronounce than others, and you just kind of, it's all about practice.
So what letters are hard to pronounce with your lips closed?
B's, as in boy, because you, certain, oh, and W's, because I was going to say certain words,
got it,
are harder, you know. Basically anything that you'd have to actually touch your lips to create that sound are impossible. So you end up having to do that with your tongue way back in your palate. And so you're creating a whole different way of speaking. That's actually, you're creating the illusion that you're saying B, but you're saying the, which I actually did without moving my mouth. And
is this ever going to come in handy again?
I doubt it. it was interesting. You know, the wonderful thing about acting is that you experience all these things that you would never come across in real life, and that may have a purpose at some point or may not. I mean, I used to be fascinated with magic as a young man and as a boy, and they kind of, you kind of came across ventriloquists in the magic on the road, so to speak.
Now, you used to perform magic as a kid. I think you used to call yourself the Amazing Adrian, yes?
That's correct.
was there supposed to be any irony in that title?
Yes, absolutely.
Good.
Yeah.
What was your act like?
Obviously.
When you were 12?
I was 11 or 12.
Yeah.
And, you know, I would do children's parties. I mean, first of all, I had a fascination with magic, I think, partially because you could pull the wool over adults. And, you know, I think it was my introduction to acting, in a sense, because it, when you purchase an actual magic trick, they give you a basic outline of a pattern, and that's your routine. And then it's up to you to embellish upon that. And what I did was I would learn a trick and then run with it and create a whole story to go with it. And that's what it's about.
I didn't realize that when you buy a magic trick, they give you patter with it.
They'll give you an outline. You know, they'll say, you know, I was at a bar the other day and came across this guy, and he handed me this coin, and he asked me so-and-so and this and this. And as an 11-year-old kid, you couldn't say I was at a bar the other day. So you'd say I was online at the lunchroom, and I found this quarter on the floor. And I realized that if I focused hard enough, that I could actually, by using my powers, I could bend, you know, whatever it was. And that's how it goes. And my favorite trick I used to do was breaking a pencil with a dollar bill, because as long as there was a pencil in the room and a dollar bill, I could do a magic trick, and it was fun.
Adrian Brody is my guest. He's starring in the new movie Dummy. He won the Best Actor Oscar for his performance in The Pianist. How did Roman Polanski choose you for The Pianist? Was he familiar with your work?
I'm not sure how familiar he was. He knew of my work, but his casting director thought that I would be a good person to meet, and I was actually in Paris shooting Affair of the Necklace, and we sat down for coffee, and the only information that I had was that Roman was going to be doing this new film about a pianist who survives in Nazi-occupied Poland, and we sat down and we spoke and had a lovely time, and we met again, and he got a script to me, and we discussed it. And it was It was an incredibly challenging role, and even on the page it was challenging, but impossible to understand what an ordeal it would be to...
Oh, sure. Look, yeah. I have trouble watching Holocaust movies because you know what the characters are in for, and you know how horrible it's going to be, and... you know, in some ways, you want to protect yourself from even living through it as a viewer watching a movie.
Right.
So even living through it as an actor, you know, must be pretty rough.
Well, there was a huge responsibility I felt, because how does a young man from Queens who has not really experienced hunger on that level, mm-hmm. who has not suffered on a real level like that, truthfully portray these things and these emotions? And there are so many people who have experienced this firsthand, and whose families have, you know, whose lives have been permanently changed by these events. And it was also such a personal story for Roman, who had lived through these experiences himself.
How did you answer that question that you just posed? You know, how does, like, a young man from Queens who's never experienced anything close to that level of suffering, how do you convey in an honest way that experience?
Well, Roman helped me suffer. that was one thing. But I basically, before I left to do the movie, when I started the film, I understood that I had to experience a few key things and understand them well. One is loss,
mm-hmm.
and loss of comfort, and loss of safety, and hunger. And so before I left, I gave up my apartment. I had a place in New York. Gave up my apartment, put whatever I had in storage, sold a bunch of things, sold my car, disconnected my phones, got rid of my cell phone. And I left. And I went to Europe for about 7 months with a few bags and my own keyboard. And when I got there, I had to do a crash diet because we shot in reverse chronology, and I had to lose a lot of weight because there was a physical transformation that was necessary, which also gave me a greater connection, not only to the understanding hunger, which made me understand the sense of emptiness and loss that I wouldn't have known, but I was practicing piano for 4 hours a day at that time. And interestingly enough, the piano playing was a perfect distraction from the hunger, which allowed me to identify with the music in a way that I had never really grasped before. And I should also say that Roman, when I say that, you know, Roman made it tough, he did make it tough in a sense, but he toughened me up in a way, because he wouldn't tolerate any kind of what he would call as Hollywood actor behavior, which would, you know, essentially be asking for something like a piece of bread. That was intolerable. But he reminded me, you know, of what is important, and I admire him tremendously.
My guest is Adrian Brody. He's starring in the new film Dummy. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Adrian Brody. He's starring in the new film Dummy. He won this year's Best Actor Oscar for his performance in The Pianist. as the pianist Vladislav Spilman, who survived the Holocaust by hiding from the Nazis, nearly starving to death. How much weight did you lose? I mean, you were already pretty thin by anybody's standards.
I lost 30 pounds. I'm 6'1". I went to 130.
Wow, okay. So that's a lot. Did you ever ask yourself when you were making the movie, like, am I ruining my body? Am I breaking my body? Am I doing, like, irreparable harm for a role?
Yeah, it frightened me afterwards. It kind of became... I have a really strong willpower, and it's something that I am proud of. And it was kind of like an experiment that I was having with myself to see how thin I could get, which was the plan. It wasn't like, okay, 130 is a safe weight. It was like I really couldn't get below that. And, you know, it may have fluctuated below that or above that here and there, but I pretty much stayed at that weight for the time that I needed to stay there. And then I would gradually increase it because we would have to slowly shoot in reverse chronology, and it would slowly get thinner, so I would slowly gain weight. And then I had to gain a lot of weight towards the end. And that was, yeah, it had an effect on me. But
what's the point of shooting in reverse chronology, of shooting the end of the movie first? It seems so counterintuitive, especially for a movie like this, where you're experiencing a constantly diminished life and you're in constant growing danger.
It basically comes down to what works for the production. You know, anytime I've done a film, it's usually your most difficult scenes come first. Your love scene comes first. Your death scene comes first.
Well, do you ever come out the other end and think, if I had only gone through this in chronological order, I would have played that ultimate scene differently?
Well, but the advantage in this film, I mean, part of the reason was they had to have seasons, and the war was at the bleakest moment was at winter, and we shot at winter time.
Mm-hmm.
And then spring in Poland is actually beautiful and becomes very green and lush. And that took place prior to the war to give it this kind of more serene, happier environment. The advantage of shooting in reverse chronology was that I understood this man in a way that I wouldn't have understood playing a man who was extremely talented and lived a very normal, kind of happy, yet it wasn't very specific, his existence prior to that. You don't know what defines this human being. You don't know what he's capable of. And the challenge came later in trying to let go of all the kind of pain that I absorbed and tried to absorb and create a sense of lightness and stubbornness and hope of humanity. But I think it was completely advantageous to me to shoot in reverse chronology, in hindsight.
Adrian Brody is my guest, and he's starring in the new movie, Dummy. He starred in The Pianist and won an Academy Award this year for that performance. Your mother is Sylvia Plahy, a photojournalist who has worked for years for The Village Voice. Did you ever go on assignment with her? Did you get introduced to people and places and ways of living that you never would have gotten to see firsthand if it wasn't for the fact that she was on assignment?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I basically, not only was I introduced to wonderfully interesting people, but also getting an understanding of things through her perspective, which is wonderful. And you know, the beauty of photography is, as an art form, is that you're capturing so much beyond the actual image, and you're conveying so much. And she has a wonderful eye, and I think I've inherited a bit of that partially through osmosis. It's also probably made me a better actor because she notices everything. And we would discuss what she noticed and what she saw in this thing. Because when she's taking a picture, she'd say, oh, look at this, look at those. Look at those birds and look at what they look like. Don't they look like a face coming off this, you know, and the way the sun is reflecting in the water, doesn't this image look wonderfully like some old European world? And it was almost like a story. I often describe my process as a very similar process, except I don't like to lug cameras around and spend my time in a dark room. She sees and witnesses everything and captures it on film, and I see and witness everything and try to absorb it and recall it later and incorporate it in characters that I portray in the future.
Did your mother take a lot of pictures of you when you were
Oh, yes. Yeah, I have an infinite amount of photographs of me from childhood on.
Did that make you any more or less self-conscious about how do I look?
Far less self-conscious, I think, because the other advantage was that she didn't ever want me to pose.
Mm-hmm.
And I think another advantage that I have is that I grew up in front of a camera in a very nurturing environment. And my mother was ever present with a lens on me, either in my face or with me and with my friends. And it became second nature to me. And so I wasn't encouraged to ham it up. I wasn't encouraged to pose. And so I just lived with the presence of a camera in a very safe place. And so, you know, there'd be a camera while I was taking a bath. There'd be a camera while I was blowing my nose. There'd be a camera when I was sleeping and a mess. And those pictures ended up in her books and in magazines. And so it kind of took the pressure away of worrying about being beautiful all the time, because it wasn't really... I didn't feel like that was what was expected of me.
Right, right. Compared to, like, the people who just get photographed for the occasion where you have to, like, look your best and look really happy because this is the memory that will be preserved and you want to preserve it looking
like your chest. Or it being an awkward moment every time your parents pull out the camera and they're like, smile, why aren't you smiling? Please, you know, this is a happy moment. We need you to be smiling here. I mean, come on, it's going to be a bad memory. And how can you ever be relaxed? And then you want to follow your dreams of being an actor.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Adrian Brody stars in the new movie, Dummy. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of The Stones of Summer, the novel that inspired the film Stone Reader, available October 22nd at Barnes & Noble stores and online at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, this is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, actor Miriam Colon, founder of the Puerto Rican Traveling Theater, talks about playing Mexicans in westerns of the 50s and 60s. Her new movie, The Blue Diner, is about to be shown on PBS. And Milo Miles reviews the new album from singer and guitarist Carlos Guitarlos. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Miriam Colon, is probably best known for her role in Scarface as Al Pacino's mother. She also co-starred in the John Sayles film Lone Star and Billy Bob Thornton's adaptation of All the Pretty Horses. Earlier in her career, she worked with Marlon Brando in two movies, One-Eyed Jacks and The Appaloosa. Colon grew up in Puerto Rico and moved to New York, where she founded the Puerto Rican Traveling Theater, which she still directs. Her new movie, The Blue Diner, premieres tonight on many public TV stations. It's about two generations of a Puerto Rican family living in Boston. Colon plays a mother who doesn't speak English and can't communicate with her bilingual daughter after the daughter mysteriously loses her ability to speak Spanish. Now, early on in your career, you played in a lot of TV westerns, roles in Gunsmoke, The Virginian, Bonanza, Have Gun Will Travel, Bronco. Did westerns provide a lot of opportunities because a lot of them were set near the Mexican border? Did you play a lot of Mexicans in the westerns?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. When I go to Mexico, I always have to be careful. I always have to have my passport because they think I'm Mexican. And coming back, you see, sometimes you're careless and you don't carry your passport with you. And in a couple of times, I remember when I was in Back Roads, that, and I think in one of the John Sayles films, that I think I was near a border town, a couple of times they sort of put their eye on me and say, "You." I said, "Who?" I said, "You. Could you step aside, please?" I knew immediately that they thought I was a Mexican sneaking through the border.
Did you have a favorite of the TV westerns that you performed in?
I don't know. I've played so many things for so many years that I don't know that I had a favorite. I do know that I would die as an Indian. I think I was Ricardo Montalban's Indian in one of them, and in another I was Ricardo Montalban's secretary, in another I was Ricardo Montalban's mistress. Many different roles, yeah.
How was your English when you got to New York?
It was very difficult. I had a thick accent, much thicker than I have now. And it was a long process to try to eliminate the accent and to be understood. And I spent a lot of money in speech classes. Then you go for a role, and they tell you, "No, no, no, don't sound so sophisticated. She only went to the fifth grade." So I had to go back to unlearning things that you sort of sharpened in the pronunciation.
Have you met Mexicans who've seen your many roles as a Mexican in Westerns and thought that you were Mexican?
Yes. Yes. I remember El Indio Fernandez, the legendary Mexican director. And one day he was drunk and he says, "You look more Mexican than the you're more Mexican than the tequila." Yo, I was so flattered that El Indio Fernandez would say that to me. It was his way and his style saying that I looked very Mexican. And I don't know, I'm very, very fond of the Mexican culture, and I consider it an honor.
Now, you were in two movies with Marlon Brando, both Westerns, The Appaloosa and One-Eyed Jacks, which he also directed. How did he cast you in One-Eyed Jacks?
I don't know. I was called and told me that I had an interview for a movie called One-Eyed Jacks, in which Brando was playing the leading role. And I was very excited. But what I didn't know when I got there was that he was not only acting in it, but he was directing it, so that the person who had to interview, who interviewed me, was him. And I was not prepared for that. So it was such a pleasant surprise. It was a nervous surprise, you know, because there he was. And very nonchalant, I said, "Hey, listen, is he supposed?" And he said, no, he's directing now. He's directing now." So I realized that there had been a discussion, I don't know, some disagreement, and he wound up directing the movie. And he was wonderful. He was wonderful. wonderful with the actors. It's a great joy to work with him.
Was there any advice he gave you that stuck with you?
Well, there was no script. And in the interview, he just more or less threw a few questions at me, and he tried his Spanish on me. And I spoke in Spanish to him, and then he said, "We don't have a script at this moment, but let's do a little improvisation." He loves improvisations. And I was very much at ease with improvisations. I trained in good schools and at the Actor's Studio and in many other places. And doing improvisations is one of the elementary things that you have to do, improvise. And so he said, "We're going to pretend that we are meeting now, and you don't want to admit that you know me, but I know that I know you." And we started from there, the kind of a flirt. Her obscuring that they had met on an occasion before. I had no idea in what direction we were going to go, but it went into just a simple improvisation of this young girl meeting this man. I guess it was in a bar. And they were flirting a little bit and sort of not revealing right then and there what they knew about each other. It was very nice. He gave me the role.
Describe your part in the movie.
My part is a young bar girl that works in this, I guess it was like a tavern with hotel rooms upstairs, like you see in the Westerns. And that's what it was.
Do you have a favorite scene?
One Eye Jacks, I love the entire... My role in One Eye Jacks is very small. I just play this bar girl, and he flirts with me at the beginning. Then I have a scene with Carl Malden. But One Eye Jacks, the film itself, and they made so much fun of Brando. They made so much petty discussions. It was so much chit-chat going on, laughing and commenting. How could he be directing? And then when he went over the budget at that time, I think it was like $6 million. My God, he had gone over $6 million. It was the talk of the town. As if that really mattered. What came out was a beautiful, beautiful Western.
Why don't we hear your first scene in One Eye Jacks? And this is a scene with you and Marlon Brando. Uh-huh. You play a young woman who works in a saloon with a hotel on top, and he's just come into town into your saloon.
Chico! Chico, you remember me?
Sure do. How you been, Red?
Muy bien, muy bien. How are you?
I'm all right.
What are you doing here?
Killing time.
It's 5 or 6 years since I see you. I hear you got in some bad trouble.
A little bit.
That's bad. Hey, what happened to your friend?
Well, I don't know. I kind of lost track of him. When was the last time you seen him?
Well, not since he was here the last time with you. Do you remember when the Rurales came and killed that guy? Chihuahua. Maybe he run back over the border.
That's a scene from One Eye Jacks with Marlon Brando and my guest Miriam Cologne. Her new movie, The Blue Diner, premieres tonight on many public TV stations. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Miriam Colon. She founded the Puerto Rican Traveling Theater Company in New York. Her films include One-Eyed Jack, Scarface, Lone Star, and All the Pretty Horses. Her new movie, The Blue Diner, premieres on many public TV stations tonight. Do you ever turn on the TV and surprise yourself by seeing yourself on TV in an old television or a movie that's being shown?
That happened this week.
What was it?
This was my husband. I had to ask him. He says he was home, and he turned on one channel, and there was I in one old movie. He turned to another channel, and there was I in a second film that I had done. The same night, an hour later, he turned another channel, and in an old television show. He says, you're everywhere. So I said, oh, well, that's good. Maybe I'm giving the impression that I'm all of the face of this nation, when actually it's just showing old time, old films.
You're now starring in The Blue Diner. What does that role mean to you professionally?
It's a good role. It's a woman that is very simple, that is hardworking, that has a sense of honor and dedication. She cares for her daughter, and she's very vigilant about what that daughter is going through, what is she getting involved, you know, like all mothers. In a way, this woman reminds me very much of my own mother, whom I lost about 3 years ago. May she rest in peace.
What about this character reminded you of your mother?
Because my mother was this hardworking. She and I would fight sometimes. My mother was maybe went to the sixth or the seventh grade. But she had a wisdom in herself, a kindness, a humanity that really determined my life. I had such admiration for her. And I was so sorry that she had to work so hard. But such dignity and pride. She was the best image I had. I wish I could be like her.
Is it fair to say that lately you've been playing mothers who are more conservative and strict than their children? You know, who are from a culture that is more conservative and strict than the culture their children are growing up in.
Yeah, and I just relish. I guess that's why the people loved so much what I did in Scarface. This was another woman.
Describe your role in that.
Oh, the mother. The mother was my mother. The mother in Scarface is my mother. So that's another instance in which I just swam into it. It was like a tailor-made dress that was made for me. The mother that also works very hard, that is very stern, that has standards in her house, that the fact that she is poor and they may not have an automobile, that they may not have a nice house, that they may live in the outskirts of the city, cannot under any circumstances be used to try to put them down or to be disrespectful to them. And this is what she did to the character played by Pacino. The thing of honor, the stern. She's the only one that defied him and told him, get the hell out of here, that didn't wind up with her head cut off. I love characters like that, and I think I can play them very well. But that's also because I have such sympathy for those women.
Do you have a favorite scene from Scarface that you're in?
The scene with Pacino, where I am watching him coming to introduce himself into our life again, and I know that he's pushing drugs, and I know that he's, we may be poor, but we are not in the drug world. And he, I know that those suits cannot be bought from working in a factory or something like that. So I instinctively know. But what is worse is he's insinuating himself into my kitchen, into my house, into the relationship with my daughter, which is all I have left, is very dangerous. And that's why I throw him out. And everything I said would happen. He destroyed her.
Okay, this is Miriam Cologne in a scene from Scarface with Al Pacino.
You know, all we hear about in the papers is animals like you and the killings. It's Cubans like you who are giving a bad name to our people. People who come here and work hard and make a good name for themselves. People who send their children to school and pay their taxes.
Please, what are you saying? That's your son!
Son! I wish I had one. He's a bum. He was a bum then, and he's a bum now. Who do you think you are? We haven't heard a word from you in 5 years. 5 años. You suddenly show up here and throw some money around and think you can get my respect. You think you can buy me with jewelry?
Come on, Mama. No.
You think you can come into my house with your hotshot clothes and your jail manners and make fun of us?
Mama, you don't know what you're talking about.
No, that's not the way I am, Antonio. Okay. That is not the way I raised Gina to be. You are not going to destroy her. I don't need your money. Gracias. I work for my living.
It's Miriam Cologne in a scene from Scarface. Do people recognize you a lot from that role? Scarface is it's such a cult film now. I mean, it has such a following.
Oh, yes. You know what? Youngsters. Mm-hmm. I've had the weirdest, all true episodes in the subway platform.
Yeah.
It's happened not twice, not four times, at least a half a dozen times. They're staring, and I say, oh my God, they're coming in my direction. What are they here for? Are they going to push me off the platform or something? Or they're going to take my ring or something? And then it turns out that they come close and they say, Mama Montana? You say, sí, Mama Montana. He's, yeah. And they have done the scene for me saying my lines and his lines. They have memorized the entire scene. But I've seen kids that I know they don't have any money, and they told me, "Oh, I own that film."
Miriam Cologne, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Miriam Cologne stars in the new movie The Blue Diner. It premieres tonight on many public TV stations. Her other movies include One-Eyed Jack, Scarface, All the Pretty Horses, and Lone Star. Here's music from the soundtrack of Lone Star.
En mi jardín un jilguero se murió primero. Quien no comprendiera, se secó la fuente que nunca debiera. Y una madre selva también se secó. Mi cariño como aviadorera, sin besarme también me dejó. Mi pecado y mi culpa será conocer demasiado el dolor. Las penas y los desengaños que por tantos años me ha dado el amor. Por si acaso quisieras volver, olvidando tu viejo rencor, me hallarás frente a un trago de vino, mi único camino que me dio. Tu
Coming up, Milo Miles reviews a new CD by singer and guitarist Carlos Guitarlos. This is Fresh Air. The ruined lives of rock, blues, or pop musicians are as much a trademark of the music as stardom. But music critic Milo Miles says San Francisco's Carlos Guitarlos proves that not everyone's fall from grace is a simple story with a predictable conclusion.
One, two, three. Don't you know? Because the honey get a go and not a bag of lies. Stomach never lies, no.
Publicity people in the music business often push a record on me by noting what a terrific story lies behind it. I always say, that is a terrific story. How does it make the album any better? Having said that, I have to add that every once in a while, it seems that traces of a musician's hard luck tale can be heard in the work and make it more affecting. I don't believe the old saw that suffering improves your ability to sing certain types of music, but perhaps it's no accident that the three down-and-outers I find most vivid had a fondness for country weepers and the blues. Ted Hawkins was the most well-known, a jailbird, a junkie, and a sometimes homeless street performer who discovered that his own failures and bitter disappointments were his best subject matter. The next is a little-known former Elvis imitator called Little Enos. He emerged from alcoholic stupor and a ruined career to record a final record called I Kept the Wine and Threw Away the Roses. He had become far more than an Elvis imitator. He had become himself. And the third is San Francisco street musician Carlos Guitarlos.
Lord, won't you help me? I've fallen again, straight from the heart. You can hear my cheer when you call in again. Help me make a new start. It's been years and years since we talked just as friends, straight from the heart. It's been one spit in the wind, two strikes I can't win. You've been calling me, calling me, calling me. Come back again. Lord, won't you.
When he was Los Angeles guitarist Carlos Alaya, he was kind of a slow starter as a pro musician. But at age 30 in 1980, he was finally in the right place at the right time. He met rock and R&B singer Top Jimmy just when roots met punk in the L.A. music scene, and bands like X and the Blasters became the rage. Fronting Top Jimmy and the Rhythm Pigs, Carlos and Jimmy embodied a certain hip bar band ideal of the times, living every bit of the wild times they sang about, as willing to brawl as play. The only album anybody ever saw from them was Solid Work, but the title said it all, Pigus Drunkus Maximus. The script is standard. Top Jimmy and the Rhythm Pigs fall apart. Scene fades. Sharp guitarist for second-tier band becomes a footnote. But Carlos rewrote the ending. With some help from his nephew Damon and the will to stay sober, he lifted himself above street performer. Top Jimmy's death from liver failure probably had something to do with it. The songs on Carlos's solo album are built from basic blues and boogie materials and familiar language. But he's not just derivative. In fact, he shows such flair for the fundamentals that you're sure you've heard the best tunes before, even if you haven't.
So now I'm loving you. Everything is fine. Yeah, I'm still working hard. Yes, I'm really trying. I'm out there every day, doing what I can. And then I'm coming home to be with you again. Hey, baby, loving you.
Carlos Guitarlos does his share of numbers like The Sea of All My Troubles, But some ostensibly up-tempo party tunes on Straight from the Heart have a rueful undercurrent. In a music world where hedonism is no longer shocking, Guitarlos's hint of wisdom is most welcome. He may raise hell anyway, but he knows there will be a tomorrow. This bittersweet attitude is all over the album's highlight, Two Tavern Town.
I know everybody here playing cards and drinking beer. And I tell you what, my dear, you can't get to there from here. I'm drinking in a two tavern town.
Now, baby, don't listen to him. I have never seen you here. Would you like a drink, my dear? We could dance and make romance. If you'd like to take a chance, I'm drinking in a two tavern town. I'm drinking in a two tavern town.
It's no disrespect to say Guitarlos's voice lets him down at times, or that the vocal help he gets from X's John Doe and the Blasters' Dave Alwyn provides a welcome change of pace. He really is doing whatever it takes to be the best he can. Carlos Guitarlos sounds like a former swaggering tough guy who's been frightened and knows the value of a second chance.
Milo Miles is a contributing writer to Rolling Stone. He reviewed Straight from the Heart by Carlos Guitarlos.
Women and whiskey.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Ian Chillog directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Drinking and loving, show got the best of me. I'm rocking and rolling. Yeah, that's my life, all right. I'm rocking and rolling, baby, yeah.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of The March Up, Taking Baghdad with the 1st Marine Division by Bing West and Major General Ray L. Smith, retired. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the mysterious Baghdad blogger Salam Pax. That's a pseudonym, a combination of the Arabic and Latin words for peace. His weblog about life in Baghdad before and during the war developed an international following. It's just been published in book form. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Hello, Boston. Okay, thank you. I just had to finish the feed.